Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to this LSE public event. The hashtag for today, if you're a hashtag user, is LSE Noticing. So my name is Nikki Sullivan. I am a neuroscientist and assistant professor of marketing in the Department of Management here at LSE. And I am very pleased to be here to welcome Tali Sharot and Cass Sunstein to have a conversation about their new book. So Tali is a neuroscientist, and she's also the director of the Affective Brain Lab. She's also a professor at both UCL here, University College London, and at MIT. She's authored multiple successful books, including The Optimism Bias. And Cass is the most frequently cited legal scholar in the world by a wide margin. And he's also the Robert Walmsley, did I get that right? University professor at Harvard University. He is a New York Times bestseller and the co-author of many very successful books. You may have heard of a book called Nudge. He also, however, has written a book called The World According to Star Wars, which I recommend. Today we will be talking about their new book, Look Again, The Power of Noticing What Was Always There. The book, in this book, they help us to understand how we become desensitized to both the good and the bad in our lives, and provide us some suggestions for how we can kind of snap out of that and make our lives re-sparkle, which I think is you coined that, right?
No, that's Julia Roberts. we stole it from Julia Roberts.
All right, so copies of the book are for sale outside, and the authors have kindly agreed to sign books on stage, so you'll go out and get the book and then come here to get it signed after the event. So first, we're going to have a conversation. I'm going to ask some questions. We'll have a chat for a while, and then we'll open up the floor to your questions. All right, so unlike many books that sort of promise to help you in your life, this book is actually written based on a solid, well-established scientific phenomenon, which is refreshing. The idea behind this book is that our brains habituate, get used to things in our lives and in our surroundings. So, Tali, as the neuroscientist of the pair, what is habituation? What is the neural mechanism behind it? Why do we do this?
So habituation is our tendency to respond less and less and less to things that are constant or that are frequent or that change very, very gradually. So maybe like the easiest example is you walk into a room full of smoke, and at first it's really overwhelming, but after about 20 minutes, you can't actually detect the smoke any longer. You can't smell it. Or there's like an AC noise in the background. There's one now. But after a while, you don't notice it any longer, right? Because it's always there. We have a nice example. If you get the book, you will see. there's a little visual image here. And it's small, so I know you can't see it. But it's colors, clouds of colors, and with a little fixation point in the middle. So if you fixate your eyes on the fixation point, what happens, and you're really good at it, is that the colors slowly actually become gray. And if you're really, really good at it, you can actually turn it into white. It becomes white. And that is because the input, in this case, visual input that goes into your brain to specific neurons don't change. So the neurons at the beginning, they fire a lot to any input, new input coming in, but after the input doesn't change, they just quiet down. And so you can't see the colors anymore. But the moment you move your eyes, immediately you can see the color again. And so just as we habituate to noise or to vision or to smell, we also habituate to more complex things in our life and in society. It's not quite the same neural mechanism, but the principle is similar. We respond less and less to things that are around us. So it could be great things in our life. Maybe you have a comfortable home or a loving relationship or an interesting job, but after you've had it for a long time, it might not bring you as much joy as it did in the beginning. You kind of don't notice it anymore. Similarly, you might not notice some terrible things around you. Racism, sexism, cracks in your personal relationships, inefficiencies in a workplace. If they have been there for a long time, we get used to them and then we don't notice them. And of course, we don't notice them, we're not motivated to change them.
Great. So you both have been in the business of writing some pretty successful books for a while now. Why this book now?
Well, thank you all for being here. And the impetus for this book is that, okay, so there are academic books about behavior and psychology that are really good. They might be about heuristics that people use. They might be about optimism bias. They might be about social influences. And then there are horrible books. Like in the airport, you see the horrible books, which are about like how the new science of behavior change can get you to make everyone give you money. If there isn't a book with that topic, there will be tomorrow.
Yeah. Our publisher is there.
And the number of books that are behaviorally founded that are based on a hope and a prayer is high, and the number of books that are based on evidence that are really excellent is also high, but not one of those books is about habituation. So if you think about what's most fundamental to humanity or dogs, who play a significant role in our book, not because of Tali, that is, I'm the dog aficionado here. Excessive dog stuff, yes, in the book. Or horses. What's fundamental to living creatures is that they are habituating both to what is fantastic and to what is horrific. So that if you notice what is a source of, let's say, grayness in life, grayness in a good way, grayness as opposed to the horror of maybe red, blood red. The reason it's gray rather than blood red is people get used to it. It might be a boss who's cruel, or it might be the rise of a government that isn't what a government should be. Or it might be that there's grayness with respect to something fabulous, like how did I get to have a life that's as good as this one? You might think, if you look at your life from the standpoint of, let's say, yourself at the age of 16. And there's nothing on this topic. So there are really good papers on how rats and mice habituate to various, and they're extremely illuminating. But this topic, it's as if there's a conspiracy of silence. Who's behind that conspiracy? No, there's no such conspiracy. It's just that there happens not to be a book about it. So that's what got us excited.
Well, now you've planted the seed of a conspiracy, so there will be one soon. Hashtag LSC noticing.
So is the rise of social media, I know you talk about that a little bit in the book, has that made this a particularly important thing for us to learn about now?
So I think with social media, we have a chapter about social media, and I think the point that we're making about social media is that it's a little bit like the AC in the background. So you might suspect that is causing you a little bit of anxiety or a little bit of stress, but because it's always there, you don't really know, right? And the only way to know is to shut it down, right, for a while and to see what the effect is. So that's a little bit like the AC in the background, but you don't notice it, but then someone shuts it down, turns it off, and then you go, whew, I feel so much better, right? Or there's a TV in the background and someone turns it off, and then you go, whew, I feel so much better. But you didn't really realize to what extent it was impacting you until someone turned it off. And so with social media, we think for a lot of people, not everyone, but for a lot of people, it may be a little bit like that. And there's data to suggest that. So for example, there's a study by the economist Hans Alcott, where he tested two groups of 1,000 individuals each. One group, he gave each of them $100 to get off Facebook for a month. So this is quite an old study, so it was on Facebook. And the other group, he gave them $100 each to just go on with life as normal. And then he came back at the end of the month and he asked all the questions, and he found that on every measure, people were doing much better than after they went off Facebook. So they were happier, less anxious, they interacted more with people in real life, they played the piano, they read books. So they were doing much better. And they were surprised by the extent that they were doing better. So they may have suspected that maybe it will have a good impact on them, but the large extent of it was quite surprising for them. So that suggests that it's something that they stopped noticing, right? The impact, they didn't really realize what it was. Now, all that is good and nice, but the biggest surprise that after they went off Facebook for a month and they said, we're feeling so much better, they went straight back to Facebook. So that's a whole other issue, and we're not sure why that is, but it could be that Facebook, well, maybe doesn't necessarily make you happy, but it gives you information that you are interested in. It also could be a sort of addiction. With addiction, we don't necessarily like the thing that we engage in with, but nevertheless, we tend to approach it. So there's this kind of distinction between liking something and wanting it, approaching it. And so social media, to some extent, can be an addiction for some individuals. So it is just one example of how we can kind of habituate to something in our lives. And the importance, and we can talk about this a little bit, the importance of taking breaks from things that we're used to in order to really see what the impact is, to kind of what we, the last chapter in the book is called Experiments in Living. And the idea is that we don't really know what's good for our life or for society without doing experiments. It's a bit like science, right? For science to know what the ground truth is, we need to do experiments. And to some extent, that's true in our life. And some of these experiments we can do ourselves, like get off Facebook for a month. And some of the experiments we need to learn from the experience of other people.
Yeah, definitely. So that's exactly something I wanted to talk about, is how do we notice that we're habituated to something, and then how do we dishabituate. So dishabituate is something you talk about in the book. So maybe you want to talk about what that is, how you can do it, how this AC in the background, actually, up until the moment I said that, I had already habituated to it. So unless someone else comes and turns that off, I might never notice it. So what are the mechanisms you talk about in your book about some things you can do?
One little notation, if I may, on social media, kind of supplemental notation, then we'll go to dishabituation. So let's see how we can illustrate this. Did you hear that Maradona has decided to run for political office? He said that because of his experience in football, he's learned a lot about people and culture, and so he thinks a political career for him is the natural next step, and that's why he's running for political office. Okay, I just lied, and I lied three times. I said three times that Maradona is running for political office, and I did that, I hope it's not a horrific lie, to illustrate the illusory truth effect, which is when people have heard something twice, the likelihood they believe it's true jumps, and the reason is they've habituated to the statement. It's easy to process, and so people think, they use a kind of heuristic, the easier, truthier heuristic. When you hear something that's jarring, and I noticed this, by the way, the first time I said Maradona's running for office, there was a surprise signal for people who thought, what's he saying, or that can't be true. And then the second or third time, either you thought, I guess it's so, or I'm gonna go with it. And that's how it is. So in social media, one of the concerning features is that falsehoods are repeated a lot, and once it happens twice, the likelihood people will believe it jumps dramatically, and that's a problem. Okay, on dishabituation, imagine you are doing a task that is not that much fun, like you're cleaning out your car or you're moving boxes. Can you imagine that? as you do the cleaning out the car task, and the imagination doesn't see this, as horrible as it feels in the anticipation and in the first, let's say, 10 minutes, it gets better. So the cleaning out the car, it's true I've started a little company for cleaning out cars, and I'm hoping you'll work for our company. No, that's not true. This is not an entrepreneurial effort. Efforts to clean out cars get less unpleasant as people continue. And if you're having some great experience, let's say listening to music or something, the experience tends to get less good over time, even if the music's really great. An illustration of this is Tali's own work, independent of the book, that is a high point in my view of the book, which shows that the best part of a vacation, like in a tropical area, is guess when? First day, second day, third day? 43 hours in. That's the high point. And 43 hours in is great because people are used to the place and they don't have the, you know, minor irritant of getting set up, but they still have the amazement and the astonishment, the beach, the hotel, the warmth, the swimming, etc. And then after that, it's downhill. They're not terribly downhill. It doesn't get bad, but it's just not as good as the 43rd hour, which suggests that for good experiences, to break them up into units is counterintuitively smart in terms of well-being, because you dishabituate after the break, and then you hear the amazing song again, or the second half, or you have a second vacation in the amazing place, and then you have two 43rd hours. Is this clear? So breaking up is an experience, is a form of dishabituation. To do that for good things is in the interest of the individual, because then you have a resparkle of the amazingness. To break up a bad experience is not a good thing, because then you dishabituate to the badness and it the opposite of sparkles. I think the word is restinks, something like that, which is not in the book, thank goodness. And that is a clue. So Julia Roberts, the hero of the book, who is the source of the term resparkling, was asked recently-ish, while we were in the midst of the book, what's a perfect day for you? She says, a perfect day, I get up, I make breakfast for my family, I take my kids to school, I get ready for lunch with my husband. We have lunch, and now it's time to start thinking about picking my kids up after school. Then she stops herself, she gets self-conscious, and she says, it's boring, but because of my job, I go away for weeks on end, and then when I come back, it's surrounded by pixie dust. It resparkles. So she dishabituates. Now, all of us can dishabituate either in our imagination by having a willed mental image of what our life would be were it not what it now is, or by going somewhere for a weekend, or doing something in your job that's different from what you're now doing, or taking a vacation or a sabbatical. I'm looking at you, Professor Dolan, who in a different place, who's taking some time in a different place. Fortunately, it's where I work, so I'm excited to see him. And that process of, we can think of sabbaticals as a general thing, not a specific thing. And there are people in society who are dishabituation entrepreneurs. It's their job to get people to dishabituate to what their life is, and Martin Luther King was one.
Yeah, sure. So I think so. Dishabituation is we make a change, like moving our eyes, and now we can respond to the things that we stop responding to. And the two ways to do it is breaks or changes, diversifying our lives. And so with breaks, it could even be like breaks to something that is very simple. So I think one of the most surprising experiments for me that we describe in the book is one where they ask people to think about a song that they like, and then they ask them, would you rather hear the song from beginning to end, no interruptions, or would you rather hear the song with interruptions? So what do you think? Who rather would listen to the song beginning to end, no interruptions? Okay. Who wants interruptions? Okay. Three people, four. Okay. So you know, they found exactly what we just saw here, which is 99% of the people said, I don't want interruptions. I want to listen to the song from beginning to end, right? It's super intuitive. However, when they actually did the experiment and they tested it, they found that people enjoyed the song more if they had interruptions during the song. And the reason is that once they had a little break, so at the beginning you start listening to the song, the joy is high, and it goes down a little bit. You're still happy, but it goes down a little bit. But if you break it up and do something else, and then you come back to the song, the joy like bounces up again, and then starts going down, bounces up. So overall, the amount of joy was greater with breaks than without breaks, when the joy would just go down from beginning to end. And they found that the people were willing to pay double to listen to the concert, to the music in concert, if they had the breaks versus when they didn't. And of course, they didn't expect that. And they did the same with massages, and they found the same thing. People enjoyed the massage more if they had interruptions rather than from beginning to end, no interruptions. But they didn't expect that to be the case. So when asked, they said, I don't want interruptions. I want it beginning to end, right? But those breaks are dishabituating. And you could break up things to these small things like songs or massages, but also, as Cass suggests, to life. Like what Julia Roberts is describing is that she breaks up her life, right? She goes away, she comes back, and then she sees things in a different light, which I think most of us have this experience of you go away perhaps for a job, like a work thing for a week or two, or even for a few days, and then you come back, and then you're kind of dishabituated, right? So things look resparkled. And I think it's also the little things. We had another wonderful quote from Jodie Foster, which we found after we finished the book, so it's not in the book, but she describes how she left to film in a different location, and then after 6 months, she got back to her home, and she says that once she got back, everything looked amazing. Like an avocado seemed so amazing to her, and she was so excited to go to the gym. Things that like 6 months ago she felt bored by, but now seem so amazing because she spent 6 months somewhere else where she didn't have access to the gym or to avocados. So that's the idea of breaking up. And the second related principle is diversifying and making changes. So the idea is that things that, and this actually also relates to, things that if you ask people, like what makes a good life, right? And so usually they start by saying happiness. I want to be happy. I want to feel joy. I don't want to be sad. And if you ask, okay, what else? You want to be happy, great. What else matters? The second thing people usually say is meaning, right? I want to have a life with meaning and purpose. And that makes sense. But the things that cause people to feel happiness and to feel purpose tend to do so less over time because of habituation. So even if someone is doing very purposeful job like cancer research, for example, over time, the sense of purpose does tend to be reduced and may kind of feel like just mundane, routine type of jobs, right? But there's an unexpected third ingredient to a good life which can counter the effect of habituation to happiness and purposefulness, which is variety. So people who have more of a varied life, they maybe live in different places, they worked on different projects, different jobs, they interact with different type of people, they tend to have a more diverse life and a more psychologically rich life. And this diversity, what it does, it's dishabituation, right? And what it does, it tends to put people in a state of learning. Because if you move from one environment to another environment, you need to learn the rules, right? You're interacting with different people, you need to learn the hierarchies. You're taking a course in something that is outside of your field, that's learning. So anytime we're making a change, we're actually putting ourselves in a state of learning. And there's data showing that learning is something that really increases people's joy, and people like to see themselves as learning and progressing. And one study that actually was conducted at UCL by Blaine and Rutledge, they had people complete a task, and if they did well, they got money for the task. And what they found is that people were happy when they got money, but they were actually happier when they learned something new about the task. So learning actually made people happier than material goods or money. So we habituate to material goods, but we can't habituate to learning because learning by definition is change, and we can't habituate to change. So diversifying our life is one way to dishabituate, and then breaks is another way to dishabituate.
And you guys talk in the book at the end about experiments and living, which you already, I think, you mentioned. And it seems like there's a wide variety of ways to do that, especially now with VR and things. So is that another way that you can dishabituate? And how do you, what is an experiment in living? And also, this anecdote involves Marco Polo.
Okay, so John Stuart Mill, in his book on liberty, emphasized the importance of experiments in living. And you can see Mill, at least in retrospect, as having a strong intuitive awareness of the deadening effects of habituation. Now, if you are, let's say, having a good life in which there's little change, it might be that age X, the world is gray, and you have a crisis. And we speculate that the midlife crisis, which was observed in many nations, though at different ages, is frequently a product of the graying of people's life experience. That there aren't experiments of living in anymore. When you're 20, you might fall in love in the next half hour, your heart might be broken, you might learn something that will completely change your life, you might be turned around, which is not calming, but which is a state of change and a dishabituated state. Many people in midlife, things are good, but they're steady as she goes, and that's can be a crisis for people. They see too much gray around. So we can have experiments in living by trying something quite new. It can be, well, in the US government, this is part of my own neck of the woods. There's something, a weird word I learned called detail, which has nothing to do with detail. Why this is the word is extremely mystifying, but people can be detailed from one part of the government to another part of the government. So they could be detailed from the Environmental Protection Agency to the White House, or detailed from the Environmental Protection Agency to the Department of State. And people love it. And why this would be so amazing seemed to me at first mysterious in the extreme, because the Environmental Protection Agency is really good. Why would you go to some place that's also maybe really good but different? And that's why people love it, because it's an experimented living. People go from being, you know, an analyst, let's say, who's focused on clean air and clean water, to an analyst who's concerned with national security issues. And when they go back to the Environmental Protection Agency, clean air and clean water, it's like avocados for Jodie Foster. It's amazing. And we can all do that by spending, let's say, a summer doing X or Y or Z, or taking a course in something, or learning something that leads to a habit or a pattern. And even if we abandon those things, the rest of our life will seem full of color, predictably, because there's an experimented living. And of course, with current technologies, the opportunity for experiments in living, even like tomorrow, is unprecedented. If you want, you can have an experiment of living, courtesy of technology, in which you spend some time in a place very, very different. I might just note that I've spent the last couple days in London, and London is amazing. I don't know if you see it. Do you see the streets, the history, the people? It's like a flash of colors that they just don't have in Massachusetts. of course, that's because here is new to me. But I'm very confident that this is a very limited experimented living for me, and that when I go back to Massachusetts and D.C., I'm going to see all sorts of things that I'd taken for granted 5 days ago.
I now forgot what the question was, so I guess I'm not.
Experiments in living.
Oh, right.
So we're here at LSE, and one of the major things that LSE cares about is making the world a better place. And you have a whole section in your book on that and how habituation can cause us to put up with or maybe support things that aren't great. So I'm wondering, but also you say that so strict norms can actually make society better by not allowing us to habituate to bad things. So when is habituation good for society? When is it bad? How do we know?
So maybe I'll start with the beginning rather than when habituation is good or bad. And you talked about norm and strict norms and how habituation is related to the negative things around us. So really, the idea of the book started from a study that was conducted in my lab, and we published it in 2016, so quite a while ago now. And in that study, what we showed is that people habituate to their own lying. So we had an experiment where people came into the lab and they played a task, and in that task, if they lied, they would get more money themselves at the expense of another person. Now, we didn't tell them that they should lie, or we didn't mention the word lying, but they could figure it out through the task. Oh, if they lie, they would get more money. So the interesting thing was that at the beginning, they lied by just a little bit, by a few cents. And after a while, they lied by more and more and more. And in fact, it was in London, so it was like more and more pounds. So the amount by which they lied became bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger over time. And while they were doing that, we recorded their brain activity in a brain imaging scanner. And we saw that at the beginning when they lied, there was strong activity in the amygdala, which is important for emotional arousal. So despite the fact that at the beginning they lied by just a little bit, it seemed like they were experiencing a strong emotional reaction, and probably a negative one, which makes sense because people tend to think that lying is bad. And when they do so, they feel bad. But as they lied more and more and more, emotional habituation kicked in, and the amygdala response went down, right? So emotional habituation is our tendency to have less of an emotional reaction to something that is repeated again and again. So if you see a scary dog for the first time, you're really afraid. And then you see the same dog the next day, less of a reaction. 10 days later, you don't react to the dog. So similarly with dishonesty, people at first, when they were acting dishonestly, they had strong emotional reaction, and then it went down. And as it went down, the more the amygdala activity went down, we could predict how much more they would lie on the next trial, right? Because without the negative emotion, there was nothing that was curbing people's dishonesty. So they just felt free to be dishonest. So that's an example of how emotional habituation can actually cause an enhancement of dishonesty. And in fact, we have, for example, a quote by Bernie Madoff, and he says that at the beginning I don't remember the exact words, but something like, the beginning you lie by a little bit, but over time you become comfortable with it, and it snowballs. And I think that's interesting for two reasons. One is that just like the average Joe that was in our experiment, you know, for Bernie Madoff, he also experienced this escalation of dishonesty that ended up in something quite terrible for a lot of people. And the other interesting thing about this quote is that he says that he became comfortable, right? You become comfortable, he says. And that suggests that he wasn't comfortable at the beginning, right? It doesn't seem like he was a psychopath who just doesn't have a feeling. Rather, it seems like it's someone that did feel guilt and did feel uncomfortable, but over time, that reaction just evaporated. And that kind of led him to be more free to do more and more of that. And so I think one of the takeaways from that is that we really want to nip it in the bud, right? So even for small lies and dishonesty, you want to call it out, whether it's within your family or within the workplace, because those small lies can actually escalate over time. And this is why norms, in some cases, which are not flexible, are a good thing. Now, all that being said, in our experiment, we also had people lie for the other person, not for themselves, right? That was completely different. Because when people lied for the benefit of someone else, they actually didn't feel guilt. They didn't have any negative feeling. And so they didn't escalate, because it wasn't an emotional habituation. So that suggests that it's, on one hand, we're saying, nip it in the bud, right? You want to have like norms, very, very not flexible norms. On the other side, okay, it does matter what the context is, because some lies are essential or some lies are helpful. Yeah. So, yeah. And so that, and it also, unrelated, the study came out in October 2016, which was a few months before the presidential election between Clinton and Trump. So the media was all over it because it was all about lying and, you know, escalation of lying and so on. And that really triggered a lot of interest, which turned out to be correct, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Here's a story. Can I tell you a story? We're all friends now. And I hadn't thought of this in this connection until the last 3 minutes. So in the 1980s, my mother, I would talk to every Sunday, and in the 1980s, probably late 1980s, she asked me, what are you working on? Which was not an unusual question. And I said, I'm working on feminism. I'm reading feminism and working on it. And she was horrified. She said, you work on administrative law and constitutional law. You don't work on feminism. And I said, I'm interested in it. There's work in law, and it's interesting. And she says, no, don't do that. That's terrible. And it got heated. I said, what? It's important, even. And she said, no, it's not important. And you work on, don't do that. Stop reading. Don't write on that. She was very agitated. And it got sufficiently heated that my mother had real fire in her, and so do I, and I responded, and I just gave her a litany of accounts that I'd read about sexual harassment and various things that were blooming in legal literature and relevant to constitutional law and such. And my mother paused. I'd never heard that before. She paused. And then she said three words that she had never said to me until that moment, and she never said to me after. It's the only time in her life she said these three words. She said, with a feeling I'm not going to be able to capture, she said, God bless you. And there was a lot in those words. She was talking about her life. And I caught it. She was, what I was saying about sex discrimination, that was her life. She completely got that, and much more than I did. And the God bless you was, there was a host of stories there, which I'm sure no one except my dad knew. Now, was she habituated to the forms of non-wonderfulness she experienced? Not so much that they were like noise that she didn't hear, but maybe a little bit like they were social media or something a dentist put in your mouth that hurts a bit, but you're used to it. And if you think about movements for equality of multiple kinds, they're like at a very, you know, the story I told is trivial, but they're that. So dishabituation entrepreneurs like Malala or like Catherine McKinnon, who's the founder of the notion of sexual harassment, and 1,001 people working on disability issues or issues of sexual orientation, or take your preferred issue on the right. It might involve religious liberty. It might involve criminal violence. They are people who, for one reason or another, maybe because of their own experiments of living, maybe because of something in their character, didn't habituate. And then they tell others you know, here's a mirror. Can you make what's behind the mirror in front of the mirror better?
Is it the veil?
Yeah, one example, just following up directly from that, one example in the book that I really like about a dissubituation entrepreneur in the domain of sexism and gender inequality is actually a non-famous example. And it is a professor at Princeton. Her name is Yael Neve. And what she noticed is that there is inequality, gender inequality in academia, and that manifests itself as an unequal distribution of female and male speakers in conferences and on panels and so on. So what she did in order to dishabituate the rest of the people and cause change is she created a website where on the website she listed all the conferences that she knew about within her field. So it's neuroscience, but it could be done for anything else. And for every conference was the name of the conference, was a ratio of female to male speakers in that specific conference. So for example, it might be 1 to 5. And then next to it was a ratio of female to male in the subfield of the conference. So perhaps it's 2 to 3. And she also put the names of the people who were organizing the conference. And so by doing that, she did a few things, right? First of all, she made it very transparent, right? So it's in front of you. It's really hard not to notice. And the second thing she did is she makes people accountable. And people really don't want their names next to data that suggests bias. I think she has data on this, but it looks like it was very effective at creating change.
Well, we are almost out of time for us to just keep talking. And there's just one last thing I want to ask, which is, so did you guys change anything about the way you live from writing the book?
I am more pro short vacations. So the idea of 2 weeks in a place seems to me less appealing than 3 5-day visits to places.
Right, makes sense.
So, yes, but before that, we talk in the book about how Cass is a bit more of an exploiter. So meaning he doesn't like to explore, in fact, right? He likes to. But his wife is an explorer. So she likes to try a lot of different things, and Cass can discuss this with. Right, maybe, I'm assuming, different restaurants, different places to visit, but Cass doesn't. So I think, and there's a point to this, but before that I want to say that now you can say, I don't want to go to 2 weeks vacation, and here's the science behind it. But I think also the point that we're making is that often you find that you will have these kind of couples, right, where one is the explorer and one the exploiter, because in fact the optimal solution is somewhere in the middle, and so that is in fact a good thing when the explorer pushes the exploiter to explore, and the exploiter pushes the explorer to exploit. Did I change my life? I'm kind of a dishabituation junkie, so I don't think I could.
You were already dishabituated.
I'm already fully.
Well, academia is a really.
And maybe now
place.
I can give the signs to my husband and say, like, look, this is why we need to live in 2 different places and and go all over the world. I like to work on different projects with different type of people and that kind of thing, because I guess I get bored a little bit fast. Doesn't mean that I'm not focused.
Just if I can make a notation. So exploiters aren't people who take advantage of others. Exploiters are people who take advantage of the stock of things that they have. So they like staycations. They like going to the restaurants that they know to be good. They like doing what they've done before. Explorers like novelty and adventure.
Thank you. That was important.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, I think it is time now to get some questions from you all. So we have some LSE students who are roaming around with mics. So we have a question right here. Raise your hand if you have another. And one right here, the gentleman in the gray suit without the stripes. And then the one in front of him with the stripes. And then we'll then go up to the top.
I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories, or Can We Afford the Super Rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hi, I'm Ling. I'm a Master of Public Policy student at LSE. I have two questions, if I may. The first one is, with the knowledge of habitation and dishabitation, how can we apply this new knowledge into public policy? And the second one is, I'm thinking about reverse culture shock, because I'm someone that has moved around quite often and tries to diversify my life. But reverse culture shock is when you go back to your home country and you actually find a lot of problems with it. So is this a case of where dishabitation has a negative impact on your happiness? Or if you could offer a different explanation, that would be great. Thank you.
I'll let Cass answer the policy question, but the reverse habituation I can answer myself as well. I think that's a point. The point is that you will see the negative things in your own culture. And you know, the hope is that if enough people see that, they will try to act and change it. So I can see how, like, you're saying, well, that's not a good thing because now I feel bad about these things. But that is a point. That's what's supposed to happen.
The driver of change.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that people who are surrounded by dirty air or who live with poor healthcare systems habituate to those things. And we know that people who live in places that lack freedom habituate to the absence of freedom. And we know that cultures in which corruption is pervasive habituate to the presence of corruption and are not much troubled by it. And so that suggests that stipulating that bad healthcare systems and dirty air and corruption are not ideal. To introduce experiments in living or a kind of mirror to such societies is essential to produce what should be desired.
In the book, you mentioned that even just reading a book about another place can help you to experience one of these.
Hi there. So you spoke about habituation and dishabituation as almost like a way of fixing it when it comes up. I wondered if you sort of explored any other ways of perhaps putting it off, whether you mentioned focus briefly there, whether you could sort of prevent yourself from habituating maybe by focus or mindfulness or anything like that, whether there's a way of actually preventing it from happening as opposed to just fixing it once it's happened.
So you mean, I think we had a question like this before somewhere else, but I think what you mean is like using your mind and your attention to try to like notice and not...
To keep on noticing rather than to let yourself stop.
To never habituate.
To never habituate. I, you know, it's possible that someone, and the person who asks this question, actually what he does, he makes these kind of things like, you know, involve like VR and things like that. So that's a way, like, and so maybe he'll find a solution of like how to cause you to attend to things and things like that. I think it's hard. I think it's easier to just create change. And it even small changes. So there's a study that I found hard to believe, but they do have replications of this in the study a few times. So I'm assuming it's true. And so that's why we put it in the book. But the study suggests that if you change simply your environment where you are, so you're working on in the office, and then you go out for a walk, and then you go sit in a coffee shop and work there and come back to your office, the study shows that that causes you to then pay more attention to things, and actually as a result, to be more able to come up with creative solutions. So your creativity rises when you just make those very, very simple changes. Now, that only lasts on average for 6 minutes. The creativity boost. But a lot of times 6 minutes is all you need, right, to find that like solution that you're thinking of. So the answer is maybe. I don't know of a way for now to do that.
Hello there. When streaming services made programs available so you could watch the whole series in one go, I, like a lot of people, really enjoyed binge watching and spend far too long doing that. Now that your books come out, and all these TV producers will be thinking, hang on a minute, we can actually get people to enjoy these things better by making people wait, do you think that's going to happen?
Well, there's enjoyment and then there's anticipated enjoyment. So I'm going to talk around the question. If you have a good experience coming, let's say in a few months you're going to go somewhere, a lot of the positive quality of that experience is anticipating it. Yes, does this connect? That if there's a good vacation, it might be good, but the best part may be expecting it and thinking about it before. So for like a movie, is everyone in this room obsessed about the new Bob Dylan biopic? Can you think about anything other than the new Bob Dylan biopic? It's very hard to think about anything other than the new Bob Dylan biopic. Yes, you agree with that. And the rest of you are pretending not to agree with that. You're good actors. Okay, so for those of us who are excited about the new Bob Dylan biopic, once it hits the movie theaters, the experience can't possibly live up to the thrilling excitement, and we will have lost the joy of anticipating it, even though it's going to be completely amazing. So Netflix, I think there are things that businesses can do that would take advantage of this by saying it's coming in 2 weeks, it's coming in 10 days, it's coming in a week, it's coming in 4 days. That builds enthusiasm. I was thinking in your question whether binge watching can be very good, but the data suggests if you break it up, it's going to be better. And as the 99% who want the music all the way through reflects, it's just hard to think that that's true. It is true. And then there's a self-control problem, even if you think it's true. Can you discipline yourself to take a break from the series, the Bob Dylan biopic series that follows the Bob Dylan biopic movie? I can't.
Do you like Bob Dylan?
A little bit.
Okay, so before we call on the next people, I will say the thing that I was supposed to say before, but which you all already done, which is please keep it brief and ask an actual question. So thank you for the first three people for setting an excellent example. Okay, so at the top here we have this lady here in the second row here, and then right here in the black.
And then, hi, thank you for this talk. My question is, how do we assess the impact of something that has always been there? Because there's absence of counterfactual scenario, and also even with dishabituation, the time away or the breaks, it's kind of fleeting and short-lived. So how do we assess the impact?
Well, if the air is really dirty, and it's been dirty for a long time, we can assess the impact on what matters, which might be mortality and morbidity. And if there's experience with corruption to which people have habituated such that people don't think corruption's bad, then at least one bad thing about corruption, which is it produces outrage, which is not fun to experience, corruption's less bad, so that's positive. But corruption produces a wide range of social ills, and they don't get less because people have habituated to them. So to have objective indicators, and for some it's uncontentious, if it's mortality and morbidity. For others, it is contentious. It might be that some people believe that certain forms of freedom are essential to well-being, and others aren't clear on that. And if we're loosened from subjective experience, we'll have a philosophical discussion, but it's a good discussion to have. So I'd start a little with the easy ones, where people have habituated things that are objectively making their lives shorter and more brutal, and then maybe tackle the hard ones. And notice, if you would, that half of the book is extremely cheerful about things that are fantastic to which people have become habituated and don't notice. So if they notice things again and they resparkle, that's completely great. And everyone in this room has at least two things that are amazing that we take for granted. And it might be the next 3 days or more they'll have colors again.
Thank you for the excellent talk. My question was that how do you or is it there is the peak and end effect? So how is habituation and dishabituation, does it differ from that approach, or is it similar?
So the peak end effect is the effect by which we will remember mostly, right, the peak of an experience and the end of the experience. And those bits will then be most impactful on our valuation of something. What habituation suggests, for example, if you take the holiday, is just when will that peak be, right? So it suggests that in many events, the peak will not be in the end, right? And I think that is true both for the negative experiences and the positive experiences. So if you're going through a medical procedure, the beginning can be very painful, right? And that could be the peak, right? Close to the beginning, and then it goes down, 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 down. The end is less painful because of habituation. Now at the end, you will remember both these things, and both these things will be very important for your valuation. Same thing with the good stuff, right? The holiday, you remember the peak, and you remember the end. The end will be joyful, but it won't be as joyful as this point. And those two points will be most impactful on your evaluation. When Casta mentioned this project that I did with a tourism company, where they had the data that 43 hours in was the most happiest part of the holiday. But the other really interesting thing was when we asked them what was the best bit, and they just wrote down or told us what the best bit was, there was one word that repeated more than any other words, and that was the word first. Right, the first view of the ocean, the first cocktail that I had, the first sandcastle that I built. The second view of the ocean was quite good, and also the second cocktail, third, fourth, fifth cocktail was still very good.
I'm going on your vacation.
Come work for the tourism finance. But the first was great, right? Because that was a novel and more exciting. So it seems from habituation that maybe those peaks will be more towards the first.
Okay, so we'll take three more from down here. We have the lady right here, and then, oh, the man in the brown, perhaps Carhartt, and then the woman here right in the center. Sorry, in the black, so yeah.
So I just wanted to ask you, there's a lot of research and a lot of books, maybe the good ones or the bad ones, on habits and routines and the benefits of those. And that's kind of almost contradictory, maybe a corollary to your research and trying new things and not necessarily getting habituated to things. So I just wanted to know your thoughts on the benefits of, I guess, habits and routines.
Okay, so these are different topics, and it's an artifact of the English language that the word habit is part of the word habituation. So if you have a habit in which, let's say, you exercise every day, that's good in the sense that it's healthy, or if you have a habit in which you have a lot of alcohol every night, that's a bad habit. And so developing beneficial routines to self or harmful routines to self is very relevant to well-being, and because habits tend to be persistent, that's usable for encouraging fantastic things or dangerous for promoting bad things. Now, habituation is diminishing sensitivity to a stimuli, the stimulus that's constant or very slowly changing. And that's just a very different idea, and it could be easy to think a book about habituation is a book about habits. It isn't. There's a connection, which is if you develop a habit of, let's say, running every Saturday and Sunday, it may be that the stress and unpleasantness at the first time of running, let's just stipulate it is, diminishes over time, and therefore the habit becomes more welcome than you would ever have anticipated. So habituation makes, let's say, the development of challenging habits more possible. And I'm thinking with respect to some habit that's thrilling, it's something that people do that's fantastic, it's likelihood that the thrillingness of the thing will diminish over time.
So I think also, you know, we do talk in the book a lot about diversifying, trying new things, which is the opposite of doing the same thing, which is more like routines and habit. And I think the important point to remember is it's not that one thing is good, right? It's not that habits are good or habits are bad or diversifying your life is good or bad. It depends what your goal is for a specific thing. So if, as Cass said, the goal is to start exercising, so to start it, then you might want to have a habit where, like, I'm going to do it every day at 9 a.m., right? But after you've done it for a while, at that point, maybe you want to start diversifying in order to have more impact on your muscles, in order to have more enjoyment from it. But I think it is important, because there has been so many books and so much attention on habits, to kind of look at the other side of the coin as well, which is what happens when we do the same thing again and again and again and again, and what is the benefit of changing things? And I think so there's not one thing. It's important to kind of think about everything and their benefits and disadvantages in different contexts. But I think that your question also made me realize that I don't think we actually talked about why we have habituation and why it's so important, right? We're talking a lot about, like, oh, it could cause you not to feel joy, it could cause you not to see the bad things, but why do we have it? And the fact that we have it as humans, and every other animal has it as well, and every human has it, suggests that there's an adaptive function to it. And there are several adaptive functions. One is just pure survival, because the fact that we stop responding to things that are there means that we have resources to respond to the new thing that's coming our way, right? There's going to be a lion coming your way. You have resources and you're prepared to act. So that's really important for our survival. And also it's important for motivation. So if you think back to your first entry-level job, you were probably really excited and happy about that entry-level job. But if you were excited and happy about that entry-level job 10 years later, you're going to be motivated to go and get that next job, the next promotion, right? So habituation actually enhances our motivation, so it makes it more likely that we will progress as an individual and as society, as a species, try new things and develop. And I'm surprised that we didn't talk about this either. It's also important for our mental health. We have a whole chapter on mental health. And in fact, you see that problems in habituation, you can see them in almost every mental health condition. It comes in different flavors. It's not the same flavor. In schizophrenia, for example, you might see less habituation to faces or other type of, like, auditory stimuli. In depression, you see that people with depression tend to habituate slower to negative events that happen in their life. So for example, a great study was conducted in the University of Miami by Aaron Heller, where he had students that just got the results of a really important exam. He asked them how they were feeling, and then he continued to ask them how they were feeling every 45 minutes throughout the day. And what he found was that when people got a bad grade, everyone was feeling really bad. It didn't matter if they had a history of depression or no depression, totally healthy. Everyone was feeling bad. The difference was how fast they bounced back, right? So people with depression, they bounce back much slower. So they tended to ruminate over the negative, over the bad grade, and so it took them longer to bounce back. While the healthy individuals without a history of depression or no depression symptoms, it took them less hours. I think it was like half the amount of time. So that's another adaptive function of habituating, in this case, habituating to bad things that we can't change, right? Loss of a loved one. It's good that we habituate, because that allows us to continue with our life.
You, in part, just answered my question, actually. I was curious about the evolutionary drivers. But in particular, just building on what you said, you might habituate to crickets out in the countryside so you can hear the lion roaring, but your lying example might have a completely different sort of evolutionary driver about the social dynamics of lying. Do you therefore think they're kind of two completely separate phenomena that just share a kind of the same quality of habituation? Or do you think there is actually something underneath it linking them all, some almost core evolutionary driver that connects those things?
So I think the principle is the same. The principle that we respond less and less and less to things that are constant or repeated is the same for all these examples. So the principle is the same. How it manifests itself in terms of, like, mechanism and neural mechanism, that's different. And then in terms of the adaptive function, so on one hand, it could be that we have this principle because it is adaptive for a few important things, but a side effect of that is that it results in other things that are not adaptive. So if it, you know, it comes to lying, I mean, we probably can come up with a reason why that would be adaptive, but, and I can come up with something and tell you what it is, but I'm not sure that that is a point, a meaning that it could have happened just because there's emotional habituation, not because emotional habituation to lying is good, right? Just because there is a principle that in general is good, and then you can find all these cases where it's not helpful. And so it may not be helpful to try to find an adaptive mechanism to it. But if I had to, in the case of lying, you know, the reason you habituate to dishonesty and lying is you're not caught, right? Like, I'm sure Bernie Madoff is no longer, well, before, he wasn't, he dishabituated to lying, right, once he was caught, right? So in our experiment, you're not caught. You keep getting, like, rewards, right? And so once you get caught, then you dishabituate. So perhaps, like, if you think about, like, oh, why is it, like, a good optimal thing, and just in terms of, like, the resources that I get, well, because you lie and you get more resources, so maybe that's kind of, but of course, then you think about a societal, if you think about the societal benefit, there isn't to that specific thing. So that's a long way to say that I don't think every example will have an adaptive function, but if the principle itself does.
Hiya. So I was just wondering, does it matter where the change comes from? Like, is the impact better if the change is intentional from you versus an external influence? Like, is there any impact on that?
Well, in terms of the effect on dishabituation, it shouldn't matter. So if you found yourself magically transported to a very different place for a week and then came back, there would be resparkling. And if you decided to go to the same place by your own agency, the same would happen. People care about their agency, so it may be that intentional dishabituation has some, people might take pride in their own management of their life that they wouldn't if it happened by accident or edict. But in terms of the effect on one's own experience of the things that have lost color, it should be the same.
But it is related to this really well-known effect that if you choose something yourself, you are then more committed to it. You believe that it's better than if someone else made the same choice for you. And so that's been shown a lot of times, right? This is a cognitive dissonance, it's called, or choice-induced preference change. And it turns out that that's true also if you think you made the choice yourself, but you didn't really make it yourself. So we have a study in which that's exactly what we did, unrelated to dishabituation, but I'll just tell you about it, where we tell you that you're about to see two vacation destinations every time you see two vacations. So maybe, like, I show you Paris and Miami, but it's going to be shown very, very, very quickly. So you won't be able to consciously be able to see what it is, but your unconscious, we tell you, will be able to perceive it. And then we ask you to just choose which one you want. So these things flick, and you have to say which vacation you prefer. In fact, we don't show you any words. We just show you, like, random kind of, like, visual noise. But once you choose something, let's say you choose the right side, we tell you, oh, you chose Miami over Paris. And we do that many, many times. And what we find is that when people believe that they chose something, so you think you chose Miami, you then think Miami is a better destination than you just a few seconds before you chose it. So just a perception that you made a choice yourself changes the way that you value the different options. And it doesn't work if, like, you know, your friend chooses Miami a vacation destination for you.
Okay, let's take a couple questions up here. Okay, so the gentleman in the burgundy with his hand very high up, and then also the woman in black here, that black, I can't tell, with glasses.
Thank you. My name is Antonius from the UCL. My question is, do you have any suggestion for the optimist person? For the optimist person to be more realist, without sacrifice their passionate out of them. So yeah, maybe you can reflect both on your previous book, what the ideas emerged from them. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so first of all, optimism is a good thing in general, on average. So it's related to happiness, it's related to well-being, lower depression, success. So in general, it has a lot of things that are, that you know, that you have things going for yourself that is good. On the other hand, yes, you might be having predictions that will get you into trouble. So for example, maybe you're overly optimistic about your health or something and you don't go to medical screenings, you don't wear a helmet when you bike, you put too much money into some ventures that you shouldn't because you're overly optimistic, or in terms of work, you think things are going to take you no time to do, and you say I'll deliver it by Tuesday, but in fact it takes you like an extra week. So those are the negative things that can happen. And so what you want to do is you want to kind of maintain your optimism, but try to not get to those negative outcomes, right? And so there's a few ways to do that. One way is to, let's say your predictions, you're trying to predict whether your company will succeed or how long it will take you to finish something. So you have skin in the game because it's your company, right? But you might have other people help evaluate what you're trying to estimate that don't have skin in the game, right? So if they don't have skin in the game, they won't have an optimism bias. And those opinions, you can then use those, right, for your own predictions. The other kind of negative outcomes that can be, for example, let's say you're optimistic and you're not wearing a helmet. And that's obviously a bad thing, right? So you want to make sure that you wear a helmet every time you bike without trying to think, oh, I'm going to get into an accident, because that's A, not good for anxiety, and B, it's really hard to do. It's hard to change your predictions about something. So what you could do is take another well-known bias and use it to make sure that you do put a helmet on. So for example, you might tell yourself, anytime that I don't put a helmet on, when I get to my office, I need to put money in a charity that I don't like. And every time that I do put a helmet on, when I get to the office, I get a little chocolate reward, right? So you can use all these other kind of behavioral biases and little tricks to correct for the potential negative outcomes. And to do all of this, what you need to do is try to think about, given my optimism bias, what are the potential negative outcomes for me, given the stuff that I do every day, given my job? And then you can find ways to correct it, whether it helping by, you know, asking other people or using these other tricks.
Hi, thank you for the insightful talk. So my question is, I think Cass mentioned earlier that to maintain our well-being, it's good to divide good experiences into smaller units so that you keep the spark alive. But for bad experiences, it's not good to do that because it leads to re-stings, like you said. But people might have different kind of coping mechanisms, right? Like some people might get through pain better through distractions. So is that not also a way of taking breaks? What would you like to say about that?
Okay, good. I mean, there are two good points. One is there's heterogeneity. So note that while habituation is common to all living creatures, people with mental health challenges habituate less, and it would be shocking if people who don't have mental health challenges habituate to the same degree. There would, of course, be heterogeneity. If there's a task you really hate, and the idea of doing it for an hour is unbearable, then it might be that having 2 half hours, which on a scale of 1 to 10 are a 9, is better than having 1 hour straight, which on a scale of 1 to 10 is an 8. Yes, so to break up something that's terrible might not be a good idea, might be a good idea if the alternative, while on balance better, is just a horrible contemplated thing. So it wouldn't be right to say everything bad should be motored through, or that everything good should be broken up. Just in general, that tends to increase well-being.
And for those curious about what the word heterogeneity means, it means that there are big differences among, or there are differences amongst individuals, non-economists. Sorry, we're going back to him here. The gentleman here. And, the man in the back with his hand up. And
the glasses.
Yeah, I'm afraid I have to ask a question which may or may not be completely related to this. I'm a complete amateur, I've got no idea about the subjects. I'm going to ask it anyway, and turn me down or throw me out. What makes a high proportion of Americans who vote again for somebody like Trump, whereas a smaller proportion of UK voters go for our clown here?
That great British philosopher Wittgenstein ended the Tractatus saying, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent.
Okay.
Hello, thank you. I was just wondering, are there any contexts in which dehabituating can like backfire? For example, are there any like personality types, events, or you know, like circumstances in which dehabituating could at least be should be qualified or should be considered under a different lens?
Well, you need to know what habituation and dishabituation are for. So if you have, let's say, a life which is good in seven respects and not good in four, to habituate to those four might be really great for well-being. It might be, you know, the neighborhood is a little cruddy, or it might be that there's a little corruption around, and it might be that the air's a little dirty. And those things, to habituate those things, can increase well-being. So whether there should be dishabituation to things to which people have adapted is a completely fair question. Tocqueville referred to people's capacity to habituate to horror and said, shall I call it a blessing of God or a last malediction of his anger? And he didn't answer that question.
Okay, so in the top here, we have someone right down in front here, and then the woman in the back with curly hair. Sorry, I'm just trying to direct people with descriptions.
Thank you for the talk. So my question is that you mentioned two distinct instances of dishabituating, one that seems more emotionally intense, like the dishabituating entrepreneurs, and then on the other end, taking breaks while listening to music. So although they involve the same process of dishabituating, I'm wondering if the cognitive process underlying the two instances are different, or if you think they may be different?
I think they're the same. So if you take a break and you know start to see your experience from a distance rather than immersed in it, it has color again. It's like lifting your eyes from the colorful cloud, which you've stopped seeing because you look at the fixation symbol in the middle. And if you are in the company of a dishabituation entrepreneur, it's similar. I'll tell you a story, shall I, about my own experience with a dishabituation entrepreneur? There's a poster that was widely displayed in North America. It came from the Red Cross, and it was about behavior at a swimming pool. And I was in a group of people who was shown the poster, which has some kids doing something cool and some kids doing something not cool. And we were asked, do you notice anything unusual or funny about the painting? And none of us did. We thought, it's got colors, and some kids are cool, some kids are not cool. And then one of the members of this maybe 12-person group said, the kids who are not cool, they're all black. The white kids are all cool. The kids who are misbehaving, they're all kids of color. And the person who said that was a woman of color. And then the white people in the group thought, oh my gosh, why did we not see that? And that was an example. She was a dishabituation entrepreneur. She was quite right, of course. And it happened that that poster, designed inadvertently by the Red Cross — the Red Cross is not famously a racist organization, and this isn't in 1920, this is essentially the day before yesterday — the Red Cross did this, and the poster was everywhere, and some person said, what are you doing, Red Cross? And Red Cross said, oh my gosh, I don't know what we were doing. We're going to take that poster down. And that dishabituation entrepreneur did the same thing in the head of the people who didn't see it as the taking a break activity does to the brain.
Thank you. Working? Okay. You mentioned exploiters and explorers. So as an exploiter myself, I'm wondering what is the association between habituation and being an exploiter or explorer, but bidirectional. So maybe, for example, exploiters are maybe slower to habituate, and whether they like habituation more or less, is there differences between exploiter and explorers in habituation?
So that's our speculation, but we don't know of any experiment or any data that shows that. So the speculation is that people who habituate faster might be more likely to be explorers. But yeah, we don't really know. So we talked about one finding about individual differences, and it was mental health and habituation, that people that have problems in habituation tend to have mental health problems. But there's another side of it that's quite interesting, that it turns out that people who people who habituate slower are actually also more likely to be creative. So there's a study that showed that people who were creative in terms of they had a patent under their name, or they wrote a book, or they had an art exhibition, they tended to show slower habituation. In this case, it was to auditory stimulus. So they had the same sound again and again and again. They measure physiological response, and they found this association. And it's interesting to think about why there would be such an association between these two things. And one kind of speculation is, if you habituate slower, then you kind of have more bits and pieces in your mind for longer. So you have bits of like visual information or auditory information or just knowledge, right, in your mind for longer. And these things can be quite distracting. So it can be distracting to have all these things kind of floating around in your mind at all times. But it also means that it might then create unexpected combination, right? So you have this one piece of information that's very mundane and not interesting, and another piece of information, very mundane and not interesting, perhaps from a different domain or what you did the hour before, but then it just sticks in your mind, and then it creates these like unexpected combinations that can then lead to all sorts of creativity, whether it's within the art or other parts as well. And it is also found that individuals that tend to have knowledge of different domains also tend to show more creative solutions. So one example that we have in the book is the Fosbury flop, Dick Fosbury, who was the first person to jump backwards on the high jump. So usually people would jump forward, and he was an athlete and he was a high jumper, but he was a really bad one, and he didn't manage to do well. And so that triggered a motivation to try to, you know, find another solution. But to his advantage, he was also an engineer. So he had like this knowledge of engineering at the same time while he was like practicing, right? And that then led to this creative new idea that he should go and jump backwards. And of course, everyone thought that he was completely nuts. And until he won the Olympic gold and dishabituated everyone else. And so the next Olympics, 4 years later, everyone jumped backwards. At that point, he didn't get any medal anymore. Because he won not because of his physical abilities, but because of his mind and this lucky combination that he had of knowing two different fields.
Okay, we have time for one more really short question.
But really good one.
What's that?
But a really good one.
Oh, but a really good one. You're going to close us out.
Yes.
I don't know if it's a really good one. I'll try. I was wondering if you had looked into the incentives behind habituation and whether someone has an incentive to habituate faster actually influences the speed at which they do it. So thinking about, for example, cognitive dissonance, and if you're the one who made a choice that is turning out to be bad, do you kind of also go faster at habituating to the fact that it's bad?
So you're talking about something like something bad happened to me and I want to stop feeling bad. I have a high incentive of doing that. Will that
exactly help, or you chose a job that you turn out to hate, or you chose a husband that you turn out to hate?
Oh no.
So might as well just like
Yeah. I don't know about that. But about jobs and husbands, mostly about jobs. We do make this point in the book where when there's a change, like for example, you take a new job, people often actually have a negative experience in the short term because of all this change, right? And so in the short term, it's hard because you now need to learn, right? So you now need to adapt yourself to all of these things in the short amount of time, so it's quite effortful. And there's data showing that people quit, that most people that quit will quit within like the short amount of time when they just started. And in fact, what people should do, they should actually wait it out and let habituation take over, right? Because over time, those little things that annoy you that you just started a new job and like, well, where am I going to have lunch? I don't know what, you know, and all these little things, they annoy you less, or there's something like your office is not like the right size or the administrator is annoying. So over time, you kind of habituate to these things and you can enjoy your job more. So it's worthwhile to just stick with it for a little bit before kind of going into the next thing. Now, once you have, then, you know, you can evaluate it better. But I don't know if you can make yourself, it's kind of related to this other question, can you make yourself just by like wishing it and attending it? I don't know.
I was speculating as you were asking the question whether there's an asymmetry where you can will yourself to dishabituate but not to habituate, which is a tempting idea. I think it's false, and that what you can do is put yourself in circumstances in which you will either habituate or dishabituate. I think that's what you have some control over.
Okay, well, it has been a real pleasure to have you both here talking to us. We really appreciate you taking the time to come here and share your exciting new book with us. So thank you, and a reminder that the book is available out there, and Cass and Tali have very kindly agreed to stay up here and sign books. So if you get the book, you can come up and get it signed. So thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.